to the past to be ignored at one's peril. Sex no longer withdraws its partners, if only for a moment, from the social. It cannot be considered just a coupling. It is a chain of transmission from the past. So remember, when a person has sex, they're not just having it with that partner. They're having it with everybody that partner had it with for the past 10 years, runs an endearingly gender-vague pronouncement made in 1987 by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Dr. Otis R. Bowen. AIDS reveals all but long-term monogamous sex as promiscuous, therefore dangerous, and also as deviant, for all heterosexual relations are also homosexual ones once removed. Fear of sexuality is the new disease-sponsored register of the universe of fear in which everyone now lives. Cancer phobia taught us the fear of a polluting environment. Now we have the fear of polluting people that AIDS anxiety inevitably communicates. Fear of the communion cup, fear of surgery, fear of contaminated blood, whether Christ's blood or your neighbor's. Life, blood, sexual fluids, is itself the bearer of contamination. These fluids are potentially lethal. Better to abstain. People are storing their own blood for future use. The model of altruistic behavior in our society, giving blood anonymously, has been compromised, since no one can be sure about anonymous blood received. Not only does AIDS have the unhappy effect of reinforcing American moralism about sex, it further strengthens the culture of self-interest, which is much of what is usually praised as individualism. Self-interest now receives an added boost as simple medical prudence. All rapid epidemics, including those in which there is no suspicion of sexual transmission or any culpabilizing of the ill, give rise to roughly similar practices of avoidance and exclusion. In the influenza pandemic of 1918 to 1919, influenza is a highly communicable disease caused by an airborne virus transmitted via the respiratory system. People were advised against shaking hands and urged to put handkerchiefs over their mouths when kissing. Police officers were ordered to don gauze masks before entering a house where people had become ill, as many police officers do today when making arrests in the lower depths, since AIDS in the United States has become increasingly a disease of the urban poor, particularly blacks and Hispanics. Many barbers and dentists wore masks and gloves, as dentists and hygienists do now. But the great influenza epidemic, which killed 20 million people, was an affair of 15 months. With a slow-motion epidemic, these same precautions take on a life of their own. They become part of social mores, not a practice adopted for a brief period of emergency, then discarded. With an epidemic in which there is no immediate prospect of a vaccine, much less of a cure, prevention plays a larger part in consciousness. But campaigns to keep people from getting ill run into many difficulties with diseases that are venereally transmitted. There has always been reluctance in American health campaigns to communicate information about ways of having safer sex. The U.S. Guide for Schools, issued in late 1987 by the Department of Education, virtually refuses to discuss reducing risk and proposes abstinence as the best way of safeguarding against AIDS, recalling lectures given soldiers during World War I, that chastity was the only safeguard against syphilis, as well as part of their patriotic duty in fighting the Hun. Talk of condoms and clean needles is felt to be tantamount to condoning and abetting illicit sex, illegal chemicals. And to some extent is. Education about how to keep from getting AIDS does imply an acknowledgement of, therefore tolerance of, the ineradicable variousness of expression of sexual feeling. European societies, less committed to sexual hypocrisy at the level of public edict, are unlikely to urge people to be chaste as a way of warning them to be prudent. Be careful, AIDS. And AIDS, don't die of ignorance. The specific meaning of these generalities to be seen on billboards and television spots throughout Western Europe for several years is, use condoms. But there is a larger meaning in all these messages about being careful, not being ignorant, that will facilitate the acceptance of this kind of public service ad here as well. Part of making an event real is just saying it, over and over. In this case, to say it over and over is to instill the consciousness of risk. the necessity of prudence as such, prior to and superseding any specific recommendation. Of course, between the perennial official hypocrisy and the fashionable libertinism of recent decades, there is a vast gap. The view that sexually transmitted diseases are not serious reached its apogee in the 1970s, which was also when many male homosexuals reconstituted themselves as something like an ethnic group, one whose distinctive folkloric custom was sexual veracity, and the institutions of urban homosexual life became a sexual delivery system of unprecedented speed, efficiency, and volume. Fear of AIDS enforces a much more moderate exercise of appetite, and not just among homosexual men. In the United States, sexual behavior pre-1981 now seems for the middle class part of a lost age of innocence. Innocence in the guise of licentiousness, of course. After two decades of sexual spending, of sexual speculation, of sexual inflation, we are in the early stages of a sexual depression. Looking back on the sexual culture of the 1970s has been compared to looking back on the jazz age from the wrong side of the 1929 crash. One set of messages of the society we live in is consume, grow, do what you want, amuse yourselves. The very working of this economic system, which has bestowed these unprecedented liberties, most cherished in the form of physical mobility and material prosperity, depends on encouraging people to defy limits. Appetite is supposed to be immoderate. The ideology of capitalism makes us all into connoisseurs of liberty, of the indefinite expansion of possibility. Virtually every kind of advocacy claims to offer, first of all, or also, some increment of freedom. Not every freedom, to be sure. In rich countries, freedom has come to be identified more and more with personal fulfillment, a freedom enjoyed or practiced alone, or as alone. Hence, much of recent discourse about the body, reimagined as the instrument with which to enact, increasingly, various programs of self-improvement, of the heightening of powers. Given the imperatives about consumption and the virtually unquestioned value attached to the expression of self, how could sexuality not have come to be, for some, a consumer option, an exercise of liberty, of increased mobility, of the pushing back of limits? Hardly an invention of the male homosexual subculture, recreational, risk-free sexuality is an inevitable reinvention of the culture of capitalism, and was guaranteed by medicine as well. The advent of AIDS seems to have changed all that, irrevocably. AIDS magnifies the force of the quite different yet complementary messages increasingly heard by people in this society, accustomed to being able to provide pleasures for themselves, more and more of whom are drawn to programs of self-management and self-discipline, diet, exercise. Watch your appetites, take care of yourself, don't let yourself go. Limits have long been set on the indulgence of certain appetites in the name of health or of the creation of an ideal physical appearance. Voluntary limits, an exercise of freedom. The catastrophe of AIDS suggests the immediate necessity of limitation, of constraint for the body and for consciousness. But the response to AIDS is more than reactive, more than a fearful and therefore appropriate response to a very real danger. It also expresses a positive desire, the desire for stricter limits in the conduct of personal life. There is a broad tendency in our culture, an end-of-an-era feeling that AIDS is reinforcing, an exhaustion, for many, of purely secular ideals, ideals that seemed to encourage libertinism, or at least not provide any coherent inhibition against it, in which the response to AIDS finds its place. The behavior AIDS is stimulating is part of a larger, grateful return to what is perceived as conventions, like the return to figure and landscape, tonality and melody, plot and character, and other much-vaunted repudiations of difficult modernism in the arts. The reduction in the imperative of promiscuity in the middle class, a growth of the ideal of monogamy, of a prudent sexual life, is as marked in, say, Stockholm, with its tiny number of AIDS cases, as it is in New York, where the disease can accurately be called of epidemic proportions. The response to AIDS, while in part perfectly rational, amplifies a widespread questioning that had been rising in intensity throughout the 1970s of many of the ideals and risks of enlightened modernity. And the new sexual realism goes with the rediscovery of the joys of tonal music, bugero, a career in investment banking, and church weddings. The mounting panic about the risks of recreational and commercialized sexuality is unlikely to diminish the attractions of other kinds of appetites. Boutiques are expected to fill the building in Hamburg, until recently occupied by the Eros Center. Sexual exchanges are to be carried out only after forethought. Routine consumption of drugs that boosted energies for mental work and for palaver, what also rose throughout the 1970s was bourgeois cocaine use, has played its part in preparing for the neo-celibacy and waning of sexual spontaneity common among the educated in this decade. Machines supply new, popular ways of inspiring desire and keeping it safe, as mental as possible. The commercially organized lechery by telephone, and in France by Minitel, that offers a version of anonymous promiscuous sex without the exchange of fluids. And strictures about contact now have their place in the computer world as well. Computer users are advised to regard each new piece of software as a potential carrier of a virus. Never put a disk in your computer without verifying its source. The so-called vaccine programs being marketed are said to offer some protection, but the only sure way to curb the threat of computer viruses, experts agree, is not to share programs and data. The culture of consumption may actually be stimulated by the warnings to consumers of all kinds of goods and services to be more cautious, more selfish. For these anxieties will require the further replication of goods and services. 8. Epidemics of particularly dreaded illnesses always provoke an outcry against leniency or tolerance. Now identified as laxity, weakness, disorder, corruption, unhealthiness. Demands are made to subject people to tests, to isolate the ill and those suspected of being ill or of transmitting illness, and to erect barriers against the real or imaginary contamination of foreigners. Societies already administered as garrisons, like China, with a tiny number of detected cases, and Cuba, with a significant number of the already ill, are responding more rapidly and peremptorily. AIDS is everyone's Trojan horse. 6 months before the 1988 Olympics, the South Korean government announced that it would be distributing free condoms to all foreign participants. This is a totally foreign disease, and the only way to stop its spread is to stop sexual contacts between Indians and foreigners, declared the Director General of the Indian Government's Council for Medical Research, thereby avowing the total defenselessness of a population nearing a billion for which there are presently no trained hospital staff members or treatment centers anywhere specializing in the disease. His proposal for a sexual ban, to be enforced by fines and prison terms, is no less impractical as a means of curbing sexually transmitted diseases than the more commonly made proposals for quarantine, that is, for detention. The incarceration in detention camps surrounded by barbed wire during World War I of some 30,000 American women, prostitutes, and women suspected of being prostitutes, for the avowed purpose of controlling syphilis among army recruits, caused no drop in the military's rate of infection. Just as incarceration during World War II of tens of thousands of Americans of Japanese ancestry as potential traitors and spies probably did not foil a single act of espionage or sabotage. That does not mean that comparable proposals for AIDS will not be made or will not find support, and not only by the predictable people. If the medical establishment has been, on the whole, a bulwark of sanity and rationality so far, refusing even to envisage programs of quarantine and detention, it may be in part because the dimensions of the crisis still seem limited and the evolution of the disease unclear. Uncertainty about how much the disease will spread, how soon and to whom, remains at the center of public discourse about AIDS. Will it, as it spreads around the world, remain restricted, largely, to marginal populations, to the so-called risk groups and then to large sections of the urban poor? Or will it eventually become the classic pandemic affecting entire regions? Both views are in fact being held simultaneously. A wave of statements and articles affirming that AIDS threatens everybody is followed by another wave of articles asserting that it is a disease of them, not us. At the beginning of 1987, the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services predicted that the worldwide AIDS epidemic would eventually make the Black Death the greatest epidemic ever recorded, which wiped out between a third and a half of the population of Europe, seem pale by comparison. At the end of the year, he said, this is not a massive, widely spreading epidemic among heterosexuals, as so many people fear. Even more striking than the cyclical character of public discourse about AIDS is the readiness of so many to envisage the most far-reaching of catastrophes. Reassurances are multiplying in the United States and Western Europe that the general population is safe. But the general population may be as much a code phrase for whites as it is for heterosexuals. Everyone knows that blacks are getting AIDS in disproportionate numbers, as there is a disproportionate number of blacks in the armed forces and a vastly disproportionate number in prisons. The AIDS virus is an equal opportunity destroyer, was the slogan of a recent fundraising campaign by the American Foundation for AIDS Research. Punning on equal opportunity employer, the phrase subliminally reaffirms what it means to deny, that AIDS is an illness that in this part of the world afflicts minorities, racial and sexual. And about the staggering prediction made recently by the World Health Organization that, barring improbably rapid progress in the development of a vaccine, there will be 10 to 20 times more AIDS cases in the next 5 years than there were in the last five, it is assumed that most of these millions will be Africans. AIDS quickly became a global event, discussed not only in New York, Paris, Rio, Kinshasa, but also in Helsinki, Buenos Aires, Beijing, and Singapore, when it was far from the leading cause of death in Africa, much less in the world. There are famous diseases, as there are famous countries, and these are not necessarily the ones with the biggest populations. AIDS did not become so famous just because it afflicts whites too, as some Africans bitterly assert. But it is certainly true that were AIDS only an African disease, however many millions were dying, few outside of Africa would be concerned with it. It would be one of those natural events like famines, which periodically ravage poor, overpopulated countries and about which people in rich countries feel quite helpless. Because it is a world event, that is, because it affects the West, it is regarded as not just a natural disaster. It is filled with historical meaning. Part of the self-definition of Europe and the neo-European countries is that it, the First World, is where major calamities are history-making, transformative, while in poor African or Asian countries they are part of a cycle, and therefore something like an aspect of nature. Nor has AIDS become so publicized because, as some have suggested, in rich countries the illness first afflicted a group of people who were all men, almost all white, many of them educated, articulate, and knowledgeable about how to lobby and organize for public attention and resources devoted to the disease. AIDS occupies such a large part in our awareness because of what it has been taken to represent. It seems the very model of all the catastrophes privileged populations feel await them. What biologists and public health officials predict is something far worse than can be imagined, or than society and the economy can tolerate. No responsible official holds out the slightest hope that the African economies and health services can cope with the spread of the disease predicted for the near future, while every day one can read the direst estimates of the cost of AIDS to the country that has reported the largest number of cases, the United States. Astonishingly large sums of money are cited as the cost of providing minimum care to people who will be ill in the next few years. This is assuming that the reassurances to the general population are justified, an assumption much disputed within the medical community. Talk in the United States, and not only in the United States, is of a national emergency, possibly our nation's survival. An editorialist at the New York Times intoned last year, "We all know the truth, every one of us. We live in a time of plague such as has never been visited on our nation. We can pretend it does not exist or exists for those others and carry on as if we do not know. And one French poster shows a giant UFO-like black mass hovering over and darkening with spidery rays, most of the familiar hexagon shape of the country lying below. Above the image is written, "It depends on each of us to erase that shadow. Il dépend de chacun de nous d'effacer cette ombre." And underneath, "France doesn't want to die of AIDS. La France ne veut pas mourir du sida." Such token appeals for mass mobilization to confront an unprecedented menace appear, at frequent intervals, in every mass society. It is also typical of a modern society that the demand for mobilization be kept very general, and the reality of the response fall well short of what seems to be demanded to meet the challenge of the nation-endangering menace. This sort of rhetoric has a life of its own. It serves some purpose if it simply keeps in circulation an ideal of unifying communal practice that is precisely contradicted by the pursuit of accumulation and isolating entertainments enjoined on the citizens of a modern mass society. The survival of the nation, of civilized society, of the world itself is said to be at stake, claims that are a familiar part of building a case for repression. An emergency requires drastic measures, etc. The end-of-the-world rhetoric that AIDS has evoked does invariably build such a case. But it also does something else. It offers a stoic, finally numbing contemplation of catastrophe. The eminent Harvard historian of science, Stephen Jay Gould, has declared that the AIDS pandemic may rank with nuclear weaponry as the greatest danger of our era. But even if it kills as much as a quarter of the human race, a prospect Gould considers possible, there will still be plenty of us left and we can start again. Scornful of the jeremiads of the moralists, a rational and humane scientist proposes the minimum consolation, an apocalypse that doesn't have any meaning. AIDS is a natural phenomenon, not an event with a moral meaning, Gould points out. There is no message in its spread. Of course, it is monstrous to attribute meaning in the sense of moral judgment to the spread of an infectious disease, but perhaps it is only a little less monstrous to be invited to contemplate death on this horrendous scale with equanimity. Much of the well-intentioned public discourse in our time expresses a desire to be candid about one or another of the various dangers which might be leading to all-out catastrophe. And now there is one more. To the death of oceans and lakes and forests, the unchecked growth of populations in the poor parts of the world, nuclear accidents like Chernobyl, the puncturing and depletion of the ozone layer, the perennial threat of nuclear confrontation between the superpowers or nuclear attack by one of the rogue states not under superpower control. To all these, now add AIDS. In the countdown to a millennium, a rise in apocalyptic thinking may be inevitable. Still, the amplitude of the fantasies of doom that AIDS has inspired can't be explained by the calendar alone, or even by the very real danger the illness represents. There is also the need for an apocalyptic scenario that is specific to Western society, and perhaps even more so to the United States. America, as someone has said, is a nation with the soul of a church, an evangelical church prone to announcing radical endings and brand new beginnings. The taste for worst-case scenarios reflects the need to master fear of what is felt to be uncontrollable. It also expresses an imaginative complicity with disaster. The sense of cultural distress or failure gives rise to the desire for a clean sweep, a tabula rasa. No one wants a plague, of course. But yes, it would be a chance to begin again. And beginning again, that is very modern. Very American, too. AIDS may be extending the propensity for becoming inured to vistas of global annihilation, which the stalking and brandishing of nuclear arms has already promoted. With the inflation of apocalyptic rhetoric has come the increasing unreality of the apocalypse. A permanent modern scenario. Apocalypse looms, and it doesn't occur. And it still looms. We seem to be in the throes of one of the modern kinds of apocalypse. There is the one that's not happening, whose outcome remains in suspense. The missiles circling the Earth above our heads, with a nuclear payload that could destroy all life many times over, that haven't, so far, gone off. And there are the ones that are happening, and yet seem not to have, so far, the most feared consequences, like the astronomical third world debt, like overpopulation, like ecological blight, or that happen and then, we are told, didn't happen, like the October 1987 stock market collapse, which was a crash, like the one in October 1929, and was not. Apocalypse is now a long-running serial. Not Apocalypse Now, but Apocalypse from now on. Apocalypse has become an event that is happening and not happening. It may be that some of the most feared events, like those involving the irreparable ruin of the environment, have already happened, but we don't know it yet, because the standards have changed, or because we do not have the right indices for measuring the catastrophe, or simply because this is a catastrophe in slow motion, or feels as if it is in slow motion, because we know about it, can anticipate it, and now have to wait for it to happen, to catch up with what we think we know. Modern life accustoms us to live with the intermittent awareness of monstrous, unthinkable, but we are told quite probable, disasters. Every major event is haunted, and not only by its representation as an image. An old doubling of reality now, which began in 1839 with the invention of the camera. Besides the photographic or electronic simulation of events, there is also the calculation of their eventual outcome. Reality has bifurcated into the real thing and an alternative version of it twice over. There is the event and its image, and there is the event and its projection. But as real events often seem to have no more reality for people than images, and to need the confirmation of their images, so our reaction to events in the present seeks confirmation in a mental outline, with appropriate computations, of the event in its projected ultimate form. Future-mindedness is as much the distinctive mental habit and intellectual corruption of this century as the history-mindedness that, as Nietzsche pointed out, transformed thinking in the 19th century. Being able to estimate how matters will evolve into the future is an inevitable byproduct of a more sophisticated, quantifiable, testable understanding of process, social as well as scientific. The ability to project events with some accuracy into the future enlarged what power consisted of, because it was a vast new source of instructions about how to deal with the present. But in fact, the look into the future, which was once tied to a vision of linear progress, has, with more knowledge at our disposal than anyone could have dreamed, turned into a vision of disaster. Every process is a prospect, and invites a prediction bolstered by statistics. Say the number now, in 3 years, in 5 years, in 10 years, and, of course, at the end of the century. Anything in history or nature that can be described as changing steadily can be seen as heading toward catastrophe. Either the too little and becoming less, waning, decline, entropy, or the too much, ever more than we can handle or absorb, uncontrollable growth. Most of what experts pronounce about the future contributes to this new double sense of reality, beyond the doubleness to which we are already accustomed by the comprehensive duplication of everything in images. There is what is happening now, and there is what it portends, the imminent but not yet actual, and not really graspable, disaster. Two kinds of disaster, actually, and a gap between them, in which the imagination flounders. The difference between the epidemic we have and the pandemic that we are promised, by current statistical extrapolations, feels like the difference between the wars we have, so-called limited wars, and the unimaginably more terrible ones we could have. The latter, with all the appurtenances of science fiction, being the sort of activity people are addicted to staging for fun, as electronic games. For beyond the real epidemic, with its inexorably mounting death toll, statistics are issued by national and international health organizations every week, every month, is a qualitatively different, much greater disaster, which we think both will and will not take place. Nothing is changed when the most appalling estimates are revised downward temporarily, which is an occasional feature of the display of speculative statistics disseminated by health bureaucrats and journalists. Like the demographic predictions, which are probably just as accurate, the big news is usually bad. A proliferation of reports or projections of unreal, that is, ungraspable, doomsday eventualities, tends to produce a variety of reality-denying responses. Thus, in most discussions of nuclear warfare, being rational, the self-description of experts, means not acknowledging the human reality, while taking in emotionally even a small part of what is at stake for human beings, the province of those who regard themselves as the menaced, means insisting on unrealistic demands for the rapid dismantling of the peril. This split of public attitude into the inhuman and the all-too-human is much less stark with AIDS. Experts denounce the stereotypes attached to people with AIDS and to the continent where it is presumed to have originated, emphasizing that the disease belongs to much wider populations than the groups initially at risk, and to the whole world, not just to Africa. For while AIDS has turned out, not surprisingly, to be one of the most meaning-laden of diseases, along with leprosy and syphilis, clearly there are checks on the impulse to stigmatize people with the disease. The way in which the illness is such a perfect repository for people's most general fears about the future, to some extent renders irrelevant the predictable efforts to pin the disease on a deviant group or a dark continent. Like the effects of industrial pollution and the new system of global financial markets, the AIDS crisis is evidence of a world in which nothing important is regional, local, limited, in which everything that can circulate does, and every problem is or is destined to become worldwide. Goods circulate, including images and sounds and documents, which circulate fastest of all electronically. Garbage circulates. The poisonous industrial wastes of Saint-Étienne, Hanover, Mestre, and Bristol are being dumped in the coastal towns of West Africa. People circulate, in greater numbers than ever. And diseases. From the untrammeled intercontinental air travel for pleasure and business of the privileged, to the unprecedented migrations of the underprivileged from villages to cities, and legally and illegally from country to country, all this physical mobility and interconnectedness, with its consequent dissolving of old taboos, social and sexual, is as vital to the maximum functioning of the advanced or world capitalist economy as is the easy transmissibility of goods and images and financial instruments. But now that heightened modern interconnectedness in space, which is not only personal but social, structural, is the bearer of a health menace sometimes described as a threat to the species itself, and the fear of AIDS is of a piece with attention to other unfolding disasters that are the byproduct of advanced society, particularly those illustrating the degradation of the environment on a world scale. AIDS is one of the dystopian harbingers of the global village, that future which is already here and always before us, which no one knows how to refuse. That even an apocalypse can be made to seem part of the ordinary horizon of expectation constitutes an unparalleled violence that is being done to our sense of reality, to our humanity. But it is highly desirable for a specific dreaded illness to come to seem ordinary. Even the disease most fraught with meaning can become just an illness. It has happened with leprosy, though some 10 million people in the world, easy to ignore since almost all live in Africa and the Indian subcontinent, have what is now called, as part of its wholesome de-dramatization, Hansen's disease, after the Norwegian physician who, over a century ago, discovered the bacillus. It is bound to happen with AIDS, when the illness is much better understood and, above all, treatable. For the time being, much in the way of individual experience and social policy depends on the struggle for rhetorical ownership of the illness, how it is possessed, assimilated in argument and in cliché. The age-old, seemingly inexorable process whereby diseases acquire meanings, by coming to stand for the deepest fears and inflict stigma, is always worth challenging, and it does seem to have more limited credibility in the modern world, among people willing to be modern. The process is under surveillance now. With this illness, one that elicits so much guilt and shame, The effort to detach it from these meanings, these metaphors, seems particularly liberating, even consoling. But the metaphors cannot be distanced just by abstaining from them. They have to be exposed, criticized, belabored, used up. Not all metaphors applied to illnesses and their treatment are equally unsavory and distorting. The one I am most eager to see retired, more than ever since the emergence of AIDS, is the military metaphor. Its converse, the medical model of the public weal, is probably more dangerous and far-reaching in its consequences, since it not only provides a persuasive justification for authoritarian rule, but implicitly suggests the necessity of state-sponsored repression and violence, the equivalent of surgical removal or chemical control of the offending or unhealthy parts of the body politic. But the effect of the military imagery on thinking about sickness and health is far from inconsequential. It overmobilizes, it overdescribes, and it powerfully contributes to the excommunicating and stigmatizing of the ill. No, it is not desirable for medicine, any more than for war, to be total. Neither is the crisis created by AIDS a total anything. We are not being invaded. The body is not a battlefield. The ill are neither unavoidable casualties nor the enemy. We, medicine, society, are not authorized to fight back by any means whatever. About that metaphor, the military one, I would say, if I may paraphrase Lucretius, give it back to the war makers. This concludes the reading of Illness as Metaphor and AIDS and Its Metaphors by Susan Sontag. Illness as Metaphor, copyright 1977-1978 by Susan Sontag. AIDS and Its Metaphors, copyright 1988-1989 by Susan Sontag. This book was read by Tavia Gilbert. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with the Wiley Agency, LLC, and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.